C1C. Number 7B.
This everlasting I am, you see, she builds now the bridge from the past, from the paragraph before. The everlasting I am is not bounded nor compressed within the narrow limits of physical humanity. Now, can you see now the infinite cannot be in the finite? Remember, we started out with Mind and Mind saying that the finite cannot get the true idea of the infinite. Yes? Said, therefore, in spirit, turn away from the false sense and turn to the right sense. And then you have turned to the right sense, you begin to see that the I am, the infinite, can never be in the finite. Can you see how she lifts really the true creation out of the limited creation? It says, if you go out from that everlasting I am, you can see that that I am is never bound nor compressed within the narrow limits of physical humanity, nor can he, God, be understood aright through mortal concepts. Concepts. And you hear again, concepts, mind. But therefore, it needs this unconfined conception of deity in order to understand creation. You have also the side note, no divine corporeality. Do you see that that's a counterfeit of soul? Because soul is always incorporeal. Because soul is that which says God is never in anything, the infinite can never be in a finite form, so it lifts us right out of that sense of a finite concept of deity. The precise form of God must be of small importance in comparison with the sublime question I ask myself, what is coming? I'm very excited because before she said, you know, the I am cannot be limited in a physical humanity, and therefore I asked, well, where is then that unconfined I am? How can I perceive that unconfined I am if it has no physical form? What then has it? And so she comes and says, yes, the precise form of God must be of small importance in comparison with the sublime question, what is infinite mind or divine love? And perhaps we ask, oh, why not just what is infinite mind? As we are in the rhythm of mind, and they are always saying we must have a divine mind concept and not the human mind conception of things. Why isn't it enough just to say what is mind? Why infinite mind or divine love? She didn't say and. If she would have said and, then we would have had a sense that it can only be explained through mind and love. But how would you write that textbook? You know, that's something very important to ask when you interpret the textbook. That sometimes one would say, when one doesn't understand something quite well, that one would say to oneself, how would I have stated it? How would we have stated it when we have been asked, tell me, what is the precise form of God? And we would have answered, oh, I know what it is. It is mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love. But when I write, I hesitate to say it this way. When I write, I hesitate because every time I have to define what I mean by God, And after they find the whole definition, I know that the reader begins to scream after a while. He said, why always mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love? And so on. Reality consists of mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love. After a while, he gets fed up of it. To have the whole thing there. That's how a writer writes. He uses, therefore, abbreviated forms. But abbreviate to the point that the reader somehow gets what he wants to say. We would, in our conversational language, we would say here, the precise form of God is, or can, must be of small importance in comparison with the sublime question and answer. Well, that form is mind to love, in colloquial. We would say mind to love, because we would indicate with the beginning and the end of the definition of God the whole range of God. And we would use the abbreviation. I remember when Peggy wrote that book on John Dooley, and naturally because in John Dooley's work, one of the main ideas that would come out was seeing that the seventh synonymous term of greatest importance. So in her book, she writes quite often, or has to write quite often, and she writes practically on every other page, mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love, in order to explain, really, God. And I remember that she told me and said, one of her nephews said, and she asked him, how did you like the book? He said, not too bad, not too bad, I liked it. But if you had said one time more, mind, spirit, soul, life, truth, and love, I would have screamed. See, one has to be careful as a writer, you see, to write so that one doesn't irritate the reader too much and load him too much with information which he already knows, and yet be precise enough not to be misunderstood too much. So actually we would answer, or we would put that divine question, what is mind, what is spirit, what is soul, what is principle, life, truth, and love. And so she just took the beginning and end of that whole range of definition. Yes. So our epitome for this is, in soul, God, the everlasting I Am, is not bounded by corporeality. So we see that mind, the divine mind, which she was talking about in the subtone of mind and spirit, that all things are created by mind, is now in soul explained as being unconfined, as being never corporeal, as being never in anything, and I get terrific sense of this mind as the creator of all, which creates all, but its creation is never in anything. It is still in that terrific sense of the I Am, not compressed in narrow limits. And I get already quite a nice, good feel of an infinite creation. She goes on and is further interested in that kind of creation that mind is creating. And so we come to the next line. Who is it that demands our obedience? And something in me at once reacts and says, ooh, here she changes the tone. From the I Am, and defining the I Am is never in anything, this is naturally a completely different question to ask. Who is that I Am who demands obedience? And if I know the synonymous term, I at once hear here principle coming in, because principle is that which demands obedience. And so my whole attitude is already geared towards expecting that she's going now to declare something about mind from the point of view of principle. And lo and behold, she says, it is he who. See, he who. Already the principle sense, the person of God, he who, in the language of Scripture, doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And none can stay his hand or say unto him, what doest thou? Do you hear? The whole tone is principle. He depicts now this creator as a principle, because principle says, I demand obedience, because it says, I'm the one that governs here. I'm the one that says what's going to happen. He doeth according to his will. See? The will of mind, as principle says, I do what I want, not what you want. In the army of heaven, you hear at once principle. The moment you hear the army of heaven, you have really that sense of principle, because, you know, in the Old Testament, the moment you come to the 4,000-year period, the 1,000-year period of government, the name of God is changed. He's no more Jehovah, he's no more Elohim, he's now Sabaoth, and Sabaoth is the, exactly what it says here, the ruler of the harm of the army in heaven. Sabaoth is, so to say, the general, he's the manager of heaven. That's the Sabaoth title for God. And so the title of God in the Hebrew is changed. Here, for the first time, is introduced as that which leads the army of heaven, that which leads the ever-operative sense in heaven, that which governs heaven with his army, with his ideas. And here, too, you find this at once, that his will be done in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand. And you see, none can say, I don't agree, I don't go along with it. It's the imperative. Principle is imperative, is absolute, and therefore is working in an imperative way, and none can stay his hand. So God's working, so to say, is incontestable. You can't challenge it. You can't go against it. You have to go with it. That's the only way we can do. So here we have mind as principle, doing what principle wants to do, and we cannot ask him, what doest thou? He has no ear for that. He doesn't argue with us when we say, why doest thou? Why do you do what you do? Why do you do it the way you do it? Why can't you do it otherwise, the way it would please me? We just can't talk that way with principle. He doesn't hear it. It's a language which principle doesn't hear. So we have summarized it in the epitome and saying, God's working is incontestable. It's incontestable. God's working is working the way God wants to work. And so we get to know that Creator always better and better. First, we only know that the Creator is mind. Then we know that the Creator is not matter. And then as soul, we know that the Creator is the I Am. The everlasting I Am, the unchangeable I Am that is never corporeal. And now we begin to hear that creator as principle is a manager in heaven. He manages everything and nobody can challenge him. It's an incontestable power at work. The will of God is at work. And we go on to the next paragraph. No form nor physical combination is adequate to represent infinite love. And I feel at once she introduces here another aspect. She's no more talking about the imperative nature of God, and I'm listening and wonder what is she now going to say. And says that no form, again, or physical combination can represent the spiritual. And she goes on and says, a finite and material sense of God leads to formalism and narrowness. The moment I read formalism and narrowness, something rings a bell within me and says, here is the tone of life. Because life has never routine, never gets into ruts, is never narrow. Life is always the infinite spontaneity, the infinite variety, the infinite individuality. There is no formalism, it's the opposite of individuality. There is no narrowness, there is always the fullness, the abundance of life. And at once I get here a sense of the counterfeit of life. One gets nearly the creep, so to say, when one hears that it should be formal and narrow. It chills. Oh, here it comes. It chills. Huh? You feel it, how it runs cold down your back. Huh? It chills the spirit of Christianity. And you get a terrific sense here of life through the counterfeit description. Again, you see, here you have a very good example how the whole paragraph depicts now a counterfeit sense of life and not a positive sense of life. But that doesn't matter because we are entitled always to put something that is in the negative into the positive. Therefore here we can easily see that it is that an infinite sense of God always leads to infinite individuality, to bigness, to magnanimous sense of life, to a fullness of life, to abundant sense of life, and it does not chill the spirit of Christianity, but enlivens, vitalizes the spirit of Christianity. So keep that in mind as a rule of interpretation, which is legitimate. A negative statement can be put into a positive statement, if it is done correctly. And we can do it correctly because through the study of the synonymous term, we have a very clear sense of what are the counterfeits of the seven synonymous terms, what are the counterfeits of the ideas of the seven synonymous terms, and therefore we can easily retranslate it in the positive. So we have epitomized it, mind as life. An infinite sense of God always brings newness of life. Here I have put it into the positive, so as to make it easier in the flow. Then we come to the next paragraph. A limited mind, a limitless mind. Can you hear again? Limitless. Have you noticed how through most of this paragraph goes that instrument that always blows that melody? Limitless, unlimited, infinite vastness, not limited, not finite, unlimited, yes? Because that is the great sense of creation, namely to give us the infinite idea of God, or even better what she says, the idea of the infinite Godhead. It's the idea, she gives here the idea of infinitude, that the idea is an idea of infinite vastness. That's the idea of creation. This, I don't know if you can see the difference, huh? To see, it is not just an infinite idea, it's the idea of the infinite, the idea of infiniteness, what she wants to bring out. And this is absolutely unique for this chapter. We don't find that in other chapters. So in order to bring out that infinitude here, from the point of view of mind, she must say, well, mind is the only creator. He creates in spirit spiritual. In soul, he's never in anything, never bound into anything. In principle, he does what he wants to do. He is not restricted by anything. He has no restriction bound on him. He does just what he wants to do. And in life, he says, and I bring always out the newness of life, the newness of Christianity, the multiplication of Christianity. I never get into ruts, because ruts is again limitation. It's repetition. In life, there is no repetition. In life, there is only spontaneity, always the newness, the split-second newness in everything, never repetition. And then we come to truth, and we learn something more about this creator's mind. A limitless mind cannot proceed from physical limitations. Again, that question, limitless, unlimited. Finiteness cannot present the idea, here you have it again, the idea or the vastness of infinity. You see what she wants to bring out? The idea of infinity she wants to bring out. Not the infinite idea as such, but the idea that everything is infinite. A mind originating from a finite or material source, we have again mind, a source, must be limited and finite. It cannot be otherwise, must be limited and finite. So she has to correct it now, the false basis, the false source, and say, infinite mind is the creator. You hear now, the nearer one usually comes to truth and then to love, we get the full tone spelled out. So infinite mind is the creator, but we must find something about Christianity. This sentence, infinite mind is the creator, could be in any chapter in the word chapters, because that's only the word. If she would state only that, it would be misplaced here. Because we are here in Christianity where we must see something about the creation, not about the creator. Actually, creation cannot be without the creator, but the point is creation. And so she said, infinite mind is the creator, okay, therefore, and creation, now we come to Christianity, creation is the infinite image or idea emanating from this mind. And now we have really the creation. Truth is now showing here that creation is what? Is the infinite idea of infinite mind. Now we define creation through mind. And when she has done that, she puts, so to say, the finish on it. And the finish is always love. And therefore she says, if mind is within and without all things, can you hear? That's another wording for infinitude, within and without. No restriction, no limitation. If mind is within and without all things, then all is mind. And this definition is scientific. All is mind. Now we got it. See, it took her a page and a half to reason out things that if we drop a finite conception and go away from the finite conception in spirit to a more infinite conception, then we see in soul that that infinite conception is a conception which is never bounded in anything, but shows in principle that infinite conception just does what it wants to do. Nobody can stay his hand. It's a creator of infinite possibilities and operative power, and therefore brings out in life always the newness of life, until finally you can see the complete creation as an idea of that mind, as an image and likeness of that mind, just like in the sixth day of creation, and then put the top on it as love and say, therefore can you see, all is mind. And you can see again with that little term all, she means creation. Huh? All creation, all is naturally creation. It isn't a capitalized A. As if she sometimes says, mind is all. You see, sometimes she has mind is all, capital A, all. Sometimes mind is all, small a. And naturally the difference is terrific. She means when mind is all, capital A, it's the word sense, saying mind is all. Whereas if she says mind is all with a small a, then it's Christianity, saying all that there is mind. Creation is the idea of mind. There you have the climax of this whole paragraph, just to bring out really how we arrive at an unconfined conception of creation from the point of view of mind.